Bet that you saved a woman from being murdered by her husband after he'd killed their neighbor. Kudos to you. You're a real hero. Gabby's neck grew hot. The H word had been bandied about to the point where it had become embarrassing. As far as Gabby was concerned, a hero would have brought Lewis in to answer for his crime, not watched him fall 15 feet, head first, onto concrete. The other detectives in the department, however, didn't have as high a standard. When DeMarco and her colleagues called her Sergeant, they no longer sounded snarky. I was fortunate that I got there in time, Gabby demurred. I'd hoped to speak with Miss Cruz. The toxicology reports came back, and it's looking like she was drugged, as you believed. There was zolpidem in her system. Recognition flashed in Dinah's eyes. Zolpidem? That's Ambien, right? I have a prescription for that to help me sleep. Ever since having the twins, the slightest creak wakes me. Gabby tried to keep the disappointment from her face, though she highly doubted that Mariel would have known the contents of Dinah's medicine cabinet, much less have stolen from it. Any access she'd had to the drug would be a boon to the defense. Andy Baird's attorney would argue that his accuser had sneaked one or two before coming to his party. You're not missing any pills, are you? A pink flush crept up Dinah's slender neck. Oh, I wouldn't know unless the whole bottle was gone. I don't take it every night, only when I really need a solid 8 hours. You can't drink on them. Gabby imagined Dinah repeating the same damning sentence to the county prosecutor. The drugs were the only evidence keeping Mariel's case from being he said, she said. Dinah suggesting that her pills could have disappeared without her knowledge might make the county pass on the case altogether. I didn't realize they could be used as a date rape drug, Dinah continued. She shook her head in disgust. Those bastards. Bastards with money for a good lawyer that will probably get away with it, Gabby thought. The eagerness to speak with Mariel that Gabby had felt minutes earlier started souring, a fruit going bad after one day too long in the basket. She needed to salvage it. If Mariel sensed that the detective on her case didn't have hope for getting her justice, the girl would just give up. I should speak with Mariel. Is she in her room? Dinah brushed her palm over a sleek side of her blonde ponytail. I'm sorry. I thought my housekeeper would have told you. She's not here anymore. She went back to the Philippines on Wednesday, 4 days ago. With everything that happened, she really wanted to be with her mother, which I could understand. I wanted her to fight, but she was going to have her mother send money to bring her home, and they don't have much. I bought her the first ticket I could. Dinah's hand went to her clavicle, worrying the prominent bones like invisible pearls. I feel so bad about what happened. I know she's 18, but you and I both know how young that really is. Maybe I should have warned her about the kind of things that can happen to girls here. I didn't want to scare her. In retrospect, I should have prepared her better. Is she coming back? Gabby asked, even though the emptiness in her gut had already told her the answer. No, she's staying with her family. Before she left, I explained that the police might need her if they press charges. Dinah sniffed. She didn't seem at all excited about that. I got the sense that she'd prefer never to see that man again and forget about it. You remember? She didn't even really want to discuss what had happened with you. Gabby looked down at the rolled report that she knew wouldn't ever be labeled an exhibit. She sighed and asked Dinah for a telephone number to contact Mariel, just in case. Dinah had only an email address connected with Mariel's au pair account. I think she's taken her profile down, though, Dinah said. I've been scouring the site these past few days for replacement childcare, and I haven't seen her on there. Gabby swallowed the swear rising in her throat. She asked Dinah for the au pair service's name and scribbled it in her notepad, aware that the chances of the business tracking Mariel down if she didn't want to be contacted were slim to none. Disappointment slowed her stride as she walked back to her car. Gabby stopped and closed her eyes, picturing Mariel's tearful reunion with her mother. She imagined herself as that mother and Kayla as the girl. Rage obliterated all her other feelings. Andy and his friends could not get away with drugging and raping young women. She couldn't let it end like this. She slid into the unmarked Dodge's driver's seat, turned the ignition, and flipped on the hidden siren and flashing lights. Andy had claimed to be subletting from a friend that let him use the place some weekends. The weather was perfect for surfing and for putting a couple of smug assholes on notice. Different cars were parked on the Shell driveway than before. A gray Subaru, along with a long blue Volvo topped with a roof rack. The SUV's main plates and barcode on the window kept Gabby from giving up on finding Andy. He'd probably rented the same model in blue the prior week. She checked the time on her phone as she slipped between the brush barricading the beach house. It was midday, aka surfer nap time. Low tide to mid tide was when the water was glassy and the swells were biggest. The water level at the moment would be too high for big waves. Gabby charged up the path to the glass house. Inside, four men gathered around a kitchen table, their wetsuits unzipped and pulled down to their waists. Gabby banged her badge against the glass, causing a commotion inside. She watched it like a sitcom. The guys rising all at once, the quizzical looks on the new faces, Andy's gesturing explanation, followed by Chris's nervous scratching of his sunburned scalp. One of the new guys, possibly the actual summer renter, headed to the door. As soon as the glass wall retracted a few inches, Gabby barged through the opening, taking advantage of the ease with which her small frame could slip through cracks. She ignored the man shouting about warrants and calling the real cops, storming instead toward the sandy-haired, green-eyed man in the kitchen. Andy's bare stomach was braced for a hit. The rape kit came back. Gabby slammed the paper onto the kitchen counter, where everyone could see it. The girl that woke up beside you, not remembering you two having sex, her system had been flooded with Ambien and very little alcohol. She was drugged. Andy's eyes darted to his mates.
I didn't do it. I don't even know where she got that stuff. Like I told you, she seemed fine to me and all about it. Maybe she took something to be less inhibited.
Gabby placed her right hand in her pants pocket, pushing back the jacket to flash her gun. Or you spiked her punch with sedatives to make sure she'd be out of it, willing to do whatever you suggested. Chris stepped toward her, hands up in mock surrender.
Let's not get hysterical. Look, I was at the party, as you know. I saw that girl. She didn't seem high on anything, let alone Ambien. I've seen people on that drug. It makes them all loopy, gets them saying things that don't make sense. I'm a fish torpedo. Your head's a candied yam and I'm going to eat it.
The fourth man laughed as though he knew the story from which Chris had taken his examples. Gabby glared at the guy like she'd caught him cursing in church.
You have a lot of experience with seeing girls high on Ambien then.
Chris's hands went to his bare sides, swelling from the tight polyurethane pants covering his lower body.
I'm not saying that, but I've seen it.
He pointed to his friend.
And Andy here couldn't have known anything about that girl, other than that she was 18 and raring to go.
There were a couple more chuckles. Apparently, Chris was the comedian of the group.
I mean, people on that drug are walking around in a dream state, he continued. Half the time, they're hallucinating. They don't remember their own name, not to mention the name of the person they're talking to.
I hate you, Sabrina, you emasculating witch. Lewis's strange screams resounded in Gabby's head. He'd called his wife, Jenny, by another name. He'd accused her of flying on a broom. At the time,
Gabby had thought he'd been speaking in metaphors. Could he have been high?
Chris clapped Andy on the back. I know you think this guy's some man whore or a sexual predator, but until 2 weeks ago, when his girlfriend broke up with him, Pretty Boy was a one-woman guy.
Chris shrugged.
My guess is this girl was afraid of getting canned for sneaking her boss's pills, so she made up a story that a mom would be sympathetic to. That's all this is.
A proud smile stretched across Chris's face as though he'd settled a disagreement between friends and come out the good guy. Gabby wanted to slap that smile off his face. Instead, she snatched the lab report. This report also says she had alcohol in her system.
She looked at Andy as she dipped her hand into her back pocket and pulled out a pair of black zip-tie cuffs.
And you clearly told all your friends she was 18. So, Andy Baird, put out your hands. You're under arrest for furnishing alcohol to a minor.
Chris's smile vanished, and Andy, for an instant, looked like he might cry.
But I didn't know. Mariel told you her age before you gave her the punch.
Gabby grabbed Andy's wrists and put them in front of him. She slipped the nylon restraints over his hands and pulled them tight.
You have the right to remain.
I want to remain silent, and I want a lawyer, Andy said.
The other two men had shifted their weight, subtly distancing themselves from their arrested friend. Chris, however, was clenching and unclenching his fists.
You're going to cuff him? For what? A couple hundred buck fine?
Gabby nearly winced at the dollar amount. It wasn't enough punishment, and it wouldn't hurt Chris. For all she knew, Chris, not Andy, was the one who had dissolved the Ambien in the punch. He was the guy that seemed to know all about the drug's effects.
The police are aware of this house and all of you in it, she shouted. One more party with underage drinking, one more call from a crying girl saying she felt coerced, and I'll haul you all in for sexual assault and conspiracy to commit rape. And if you're here thinking, so what? It'll be our word against some humiliated young woman. Know that I will tip off the papers as to exactly what went on here. How do you think your employers will feel about that? I'm sure the New York Post will think of something perfect to plaster on the front page above your preppy mugshots.
The man who had answered the door raised his hands in surrender. He strode back toward the retracted wall where Gabby led a silent Andy.
There won't be any more parties, officer.
Detective Sergeant, Gabby sneered, and there better not be.
She took her time crossing to the exit with her suspect, emphasizing her lack of intimidation despite being outnumbered 4-1 by men twice her size. Without a cooperating victim, scaring them was her only means of deterrence. The breeze buffeted her back as she led Andy to the car. True to his word, he was taking his right to remain silent dead seriously. She opened the door and ordered him inside, certain that her charge of serving minors would stick, even though she'd never get him for spiking the punch without Mariel's testimony. She slammed the door, thinking about what Chris had said about an Ambien high. Even if Andy hadn't been the one to slip Mariel the drugs, he had to have known she was too out of it to consent. She'd have been stumbling, as Chris had said, spewing nonsense. Again, she thought of Lewis's last confusing words. He'd called Jenny a witch with magical powers, and right before he'd started speaking gibberish, he'd accused her of murder. Gabby pulled her cell from her jacket pocket and dialed DeMarco.
Sergeant Watkins, he answered.
His tone sounded respectful, ready for instructions. She stepped away from the car, out of earshot of Andy in the back seat.
I need you to go down to the coroner before he releases Lewis Murray's body. Tell him to run Lewis's fluids for psychotropic drugs, especially Zolpidem, also known as Ambien, and then start the paperwork for a prescription drug monitoring request for Jenny Murray.
DeMarco cleared his throat.
Sergeant,
That case is all wrapped up, though, isn't it? The guy was going to lose his medical license, his livelihood. He was violent. He would have killed his wife if you hadn't stopped.
Louis Murray wasn't a good man, Detective. Gabby cleared her throat. But I need to be certain that Rachel's murderer isn't still out there. Chapter 30. 2 weeks after. Jenny picked the doll from the top shelf of Allie's closet, where it had no doubt lain, unnoticed and unloved, for the last 5 years. It still smelled of cherries from when Allie had added auburn highlights to its nylon hair. Though American Girl made dolls with Allie's olive complexion and curly wigs, finding one with reddish hair and honey brown eyes had proven impossible. Jenny had opted for medium brown hair and hazel eyes, turning her biracial daughter vaguely Latina. Allie had then fixed her $100-plus doll with a pack of $2-scented markers. The dye job was streaky and strange, though not as alarming as the one Jenny had bought for Allie at the salon. She had understood her daughter wanting to erase Louis's most obvious contribution from her reflection. Still, she'd begged her not to go through with it. The red curls had been Allie, just like the yellow-toned complexion that browned in the summer and the soft bridge of her nose passed down from Jenny's mother. Allie, however, had threatened to do it herself, forcing Jenny to book the appointment or risk her daughter ruining her hair. She'd been shocked when Allie had emerged a blonde. They'd agreed she would go brunette, perhaps a similar shade to Jenny's rich brown color. But Allie must have always had other ideas. Jenny had left, unable to watch the stylist obliterate one of her daughter's most recognizable traits. As soon as she'd gone, Allie had told the hairdresser to bleach it. When Allie looked in the mirror, she evidently hadn't wanted to see her mother either. Jenny stuffed the doll into the crook of her arm, her hands occupied with the crutches she required to hobble toward the large cardboard boxes labeled Allie's bedroom. Donate and trash. Few would want a doll with marker-colored hair, but maybe a mom somewhere would see it in a consignment store and figure out how to swap out the wig for a style that more closely matched her own kid's locks. As she dangled the doll over the box destined for Goodwill, she glimpsed one of the red streaks framing the round face. The doll landed in the box of items destined for their new home, wherever that would be. Jenny limped back to the closet. She leaned on her good left leg and the crutch beside it, freeing her other arm to pull out a folded pile of last season's sweaters. She was examining the loud Christmas pattern at the top of the stack when she heard the doorbell. She stood stock still for a moment and closed her eyes, trying to decipher whether the tone was really someone at her door or the intensifying of the white noise and high-pitched tone she had heard constantly since Louis had bashed the glass into the side of her head, permanently damaging her hearing. The bell sounded again, clearer this time. She didn't move toward the hallway. It was either another delivery of moving boxes or a reporter late to the party. There was no one to visit her. The friends she'd had in town were staying away, giving her time to heal, and no doubt avoiding the awkwardness of seeing her shattered leg or asking about next steps. And Allie's pals all knew Allie had gone to stay with Jenny's parents in West Virginia until her mother figured out their next move. The house was already on the market. Remaining in the home they'd all shared since Allie had turned 2 was not an option. It held too many memories, good for Allie, bad for her, and painful for the both of them. Jenny was considering an apartment in the city. A kid could disappear among 1.6 million people, enabling Allie to avoid being gawked at by locals who knew her story. Given her job on television, Jenny couldn't vanish anywhere. She wouldn't quit, though. Money had to come from somewhere.
Lewis's life insurance policy had been $2 million, or 2 years of their combined income, and Allie would need a good chunk of that for college. Jenny couldn't complain about the sum, though. She was lucky to have any of it. Had the detective actually killed Lewis rather than startled him, leading to the fall, the insurance company wouldn't have paid a dime. The bell rang a third time, stoking Jenny's curiosity. She avoided the windows as she headed into the laundry room, angled to overlook the L-shaped driveway in front of the house. Ben stood on her stoop, several feet in front of the for sale sign hammered into the lawn. He reached out to hit the buzzer a fourth time, and then seemed to think better of it, turning from the door. The sight of him leaving her, again, shortened her breath. She dropped one crutch and hobbled toward the stairs. The banister served as her second limb. She leaned most of her weight on it as she carefully descended. By the time she opened the door, Ben was at the curb. She called out to him, wincing at the desperation in her reedy voice. He turned back and hustled up the walk, realizing, perhaps, the effort it took to hold open the door when she couldn't stand straight.
I had to see how you were doing.
He rubbed the back of his neck, seemingly embarrassed by the admission, as though she'd dumped him and he'd shown up on her doorstep.
Can I come in?
Jenny knew she should say no. He'd sold her out after all, revealing her name to Rachel, despite knowing what Lewis might do to her once Rachel told him. In some ways, Ben was as responsible for everything that had happened as she and Lewis were. But he was standing in front of her, the handsome man who had professed to love her once. She wanted to forgive him, to believe he'd been put in a desperate situation and would never hurt her like that again. Before she could, though, she needed him to honestly answer one lingering question. Jenny backed into the foyer, allowing Ben inside. As soon as the door slammed, his arms were around her, lifting her up, taking the pressure off her broken leg. In spite of herself, she leaned into his embrace.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry,
he whispered into her ear, a spoken word lullaby that she knew by heart.
I thought you'd told her. I never imagined that the girls had come into the backyard that day and seen us. I couldn't think of any other way that Rachel would have found out. I thought only we knew. I'm so sorry. Please, forgive me. Let me make it up to you.
The begging reminded Jenny of Lewis. As Ben led her toward the sitting room sofa, she wondered if his contrition was any more real than her husband's had been. After 5 years cycling through apologies and anger, Jenny doubted she could tell the difference between a genuine sorry and one meant solely to stave off consequences. Ben helped her sit on the couch and then joined her on the neighboring cushion, angling his body to face her. The light from the side windows highlighted the gold and silver in his hair. He was still movie star handsome, Jenny thought. But the pain of the past few weeks had aged him, adding deep lines between his brows and across his forehead that Jenny would have sworn hadn't existed 2 weeks earlier. He brushed her hair back from her face, examining her healed skin. None of the scrapes and bruises had left visible scars, though her shattered leg would take 6 months to fully repair itself, and her hearing would never be the same.
You look beautiful.
He gave her a wineglass smile, easily broken. She couldn't relax into it until she knew the truth. Did she tell you? His eyebrows tried to unite in confusion.
Chloe?
Yes. She said that she told. Jenny placed a hand on his thigh. Did Rachel tell you that Lewis hit me? Did you know before I came to your house that day when you saw the blood on the back of my head? Though Ben's lips parted, no sound emerged. His chest pulsed with quicker breaths. You acted as though you hadn't known Lewis had hurt me until then. You saw my head, and I always believed you'd guessed how I'd gotten it from my cagey behavior. But did you know before? Had you seen me with sunglasses on and realized or noticed a scratch? Did you know? Ben rubbed the back of his neck.
I don't know. I might have suspected things weren't good, but I didn't exactly know.
The words were the right ones, but Jenny could see in Ben's eyes that he didn't believe them. He wasn't a good liar. That was one of the traits that had made her feel most safe with him. Since Lewis's fall off the balcony, Jenny had learned to be much better with her own performances. She nodded solemnly and wrapped her arms around him, soaking in what she knew would be a final goodbye. He pulled her tight to his chest, whispering thank yous for taking him back, telling her how much better things would be in the future. A ring interrupted his plans. Ben bolted upright, clarifying that the sound hadn't been in her head.
Are you expecting anyone?
I thought the press was done trying for an interview after I gave my station that exclusive, but maybe not.
For a moment, Ben looked like he wanted to bolt through the house and out the back door. He could cut through their adjoining yards before the press saw him. A look back at her, reaching for her crutch, appeared to change his mind. He stood straighter.
I'll get rid of them. There's nothing wrong with me checking on your recovery.
Ben crossed into the foyer and opened the door.
Hello?
Mr. Hansen.
She recognized the voice. The woman's screams often echoed in Jenny's dreams.
Detective Watkins?
Ben stood to the side, allowing the officer into the foyer. She looked as Jenny remembered her, dark hair pulled back in a low ponytail, her small frame covered in a fitted gray pantsuit. Jenny's heart dropped into her stomach. She could think of only one reason for Gabby Watkins to drive the 2 hours, perhaps 4 in traffic, to see her in person.
We need you to come with us, Gabby said. A uniformed officer with the badge of the local police entered behind her. Jenny wondered how many more officers were outside. The more cars there were, the greater the likelihood that the cops suspected what she'd done.
Jenny grabbed her crutch and then shimmied to the edge of the couch. She pressed her hand into the armrest, using it to launch herself into a standing position.
I need my other crutch. It's upstairs.
Ben moved into the room, his hands folded across his chest in delayed defiance.
What is this about? She's still recovering.
Gabby looked at Jenny like she knew.
We want to clear something up. We found high levels of Ambien in Mr. Murray's blood. Mrs. Murray has a prescription.
Jenny had a visceral reaction to hearing her name united with Lewis. She'd permanently severed that connection.
Please don't call me that. My maiden name is Reed. Jenny Reed.
Gabby nodded to the officer. The cuffs in his right hand caught the sunlight through the windows behind him. Ben seemed to notice the glint at the same time Jenny did.
Who cares if he took a bunch of pills? He was trying to kill her. He murdered my wife. He should rot in hell.
Jenny knew Ben's tirade wouldn't make a difference. She stepped forward, resigned to what was coming. Part of her was almost grateful for it. She no longer had to worry about being arrested someday in front of her daughter.
Ben, would you get my crutch from Allie's room?
Ben looked from the officers and back to her, breathing through his open mouth.
Lewis murdered my wife.
Detective Watkins looked at him like he was a child, insisting upon the existence of Santa Claus.
Jenny couldn't have her say anything more in front of him. Whatever happened, she needed Allie to believe the story she'd told, and that couldn't happen if Ben knew the truth.
Ben, please, my crutch.
He muttered about the insanity of the police as he headed up the stairs, glancing back every few steps to make sure she was okay, as though he could somehow prevent the inevitable. The detective watched him disappear down the second floor hallway, a gift, Jenny knew, that the police weren't obligated to give her.
Okay, Ms. Reed. Detective Watkins made eye contact with the local officer. He moved forward, the cuffs dangling from his palm.
You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to an attorney.
Epilogue. The year after. Mother's Day didn't exist inside the Rose M. Singer Center, though nearly all the women housed there had children. Some of the inmates even had their babies with them. Rosie's had a nursery for newborns whose first screams had echoed in Rikers Island's hospitals. Citing studies showing that infants with stronger maternal bonds developed healthier, researchers had insisted that the prison's postpartum population be able to keep their newborns nearby. A relationship, with even a violent mother, they maintained, was preferable than no exposure at all. Jenny prayed the social scientists were right as she walked in a stiff line down the cinder block hallway to the visitors' area, listening to the high-pitched whine and whirling white noise that only she could hear. She hadn't seen Allie in nearly 11 months, not since embracing her that last awkward time in the courtroom. She hadn't wanted her daughter to accompany her to Rikers, where she'd agreed to turn herself in and begin serving the sentence set forth in her plea deal, 5 years for voluntary manslaughter. Her defense hadn't worked as well as she'd hoped. Her lawyer had argued that battered woman syndrome was responsible for Jenny drugging her husband and pushing him down the stairs. Jenny had thought it the right move, given the prosecution's case. During the trial, the opposition had, thankfully, steered clear of any motive involving keeping Lewis in the dark about her and Ben's affair, or pinning Rachel's murder on him, though Detective Watkins's interrogation had revealed that the cops considered both likely reasons for Jenny's actions. For a sleepless month, Jenny had feared that the prosecution might admit Detective Watkins's sworn testimony about the words of a man about to die, opening the door to charging her with Rachel's murder. But the prosecution had ultimately decided it was too risky. Instead, they'd focused solely on the well-established abuse and the drugs in Lewis's system, arguing that Jenny's desire to punish her husband for years of beatings had led her to plot his murder. Her defense had somewhat conceded the point. Sure, they'd argued, Jenny had drugged her husband and pushed him off a staircase, but only after the abuse had escalated to the point where she'd had reason to believe he would kill her if she didn't act first. Moreover, her attorney had maintained, the constant fear of physical attacks cultivated over years had damaged Jenny psychologically to the point where she could see no way out of Lewis's violence other than ending his life. For a while, Jenny had thought the jury was on her side. Several of them had become misty-eyed, seeing the police photographs of her injuries. But Jenny had lost her allies once the prosecution had delved into her finances. Few could understand why a woman capable of supporting herself, one that in fact out-earned her husband, wouldn't have simply walked out the door with her daughter in tow. Both Jenny and her lawyer had sensed the jury's growing inability to comprehend her actions, to grasp how afraid she'd been of her husband taking Allie and continuing the cycle of abuse. Rather than risk a felony murder conviction, Jenny had opted to take a plea midway through the prosecution's case. 5 years for voluntary manslaughter versus the 15 to life she could have received for premeditated murder. Jenny hoped some of her sentence would be shaved off for good behavior. She liked to think of herself as a model prisoner. She read books, volunteered in the hospital ward, and helped many of the new young mothers learn techniques to parent a newborn. Some days, the latter work helped her miss her daughter less. Some days, it turned her longing for Allie into an acute pain that Jenny could only describe as a peeling of her heart's muscle fibers from its beating core. She definitely didn't want Allie to see her locked up, even if it was Mother's Day. The idea of her soft, suburban daughter emptying her pockets and spreading her legs for a paddle detector was unbearable. She never wanted Allie to wait for her beneath blaring fluorescence, surrounded by the smell of incarceration, body odor, backed up sewers, and bad cafeteria food. Better, she thought, that she not see her for the duration of the sentence. Most of the women Jenny chatted with in the cafeteria or in the library felt the same way. They'd each wait in line for hours to talk to their children on the phone, but they all begged them not to visit. Protecting their kids from the reality of prison was the last parental act available to anyone inside. They couldn't mother here amid the stink and the sweat. Who could comfort a child during a timed goodbye hug or impart parental advice with the backdrop of bars? But here she was with a visitor anyway. It was probably Jenny's own mother bringing Allie to see her. She should have known better, but Jenny figured that her mother had convinced herself an in-person talk would be best for both her daughter and granddaughter. Perhaps her mom had thought Allie might actually speak to her if she saw the daily punishment Jenny endured, shuffling in lines of downtrodden women, wearing a musty-smelling, ill-fitting prison uniform with DOC stamped on the back, unable to pee without permission, confined to a bleak island where the roar of departing planes drowned out any bird's song. Jenny's mother was wrong, though. Showing Allie the treatment society thought fitting for her would only further strain their relationship. It would tell Allie that she was right never to talk to Jenny again, that Jenny deserved to be punished for murdering Louis. Even though Allie had seen the evidence of her father's violence, she still wanted to believe that the abuse had been a one-off related to Jenny's affair. Daddy, according to Allie, had been emotionally devastated and lost it. A heavy-set female guard, Tony, if Jenny remembered right, stopped at the front of the slow-moving line. She shouted for the women to press themselves against the wall, wait for the door, and then proceed in an orderly fashion. The door buzzed open. Tony secured it against the concrete and then positioned herself several feet in front of it. She motioned for the women to file into the painfully bright area filled with cafeteria-style tables and plastic chairs. Jenny scanned the visitors for the slight shapes of her elderly mother and daughter. Aside from an older woman with a toddler in tow and a lanky boy who might have been a teenager, Jenny didn't see any children. Jenny? A woman sitting in the corner seemed to mouth her name. She had near black hair, flat ironed straight to her shoulders, and brown skin, like Jenny and the majority of the prisoners, 90% of whom were black and Hispanic. She wasn't a member of Jenny's family, and certainly not a friend. For a second, Jenny wondered whether the guards had made a mistake and brought the wrong Jennifer to the visiting room. A moment later, though, the face came back to her. Gabby Watkins, the detective who had put her inside. Jenny hadn't thought about her since her plea, ensuring that Allie got settled with her parents and that her folks had all the information to enroll her in a new school had been her primary focus. Seeing the detective, however, brought back the memories of her arrest with a stinging clarity. She'd felt that day like Wile E. Coyote at the moment he realized there was only air beneath his running feet. She'd run off the cliff a long time ago, perhaps since forgiving Louis that first time. It was only when the officers had arrived to arrest her, though, that she'd realized she would have to fall. Officer Watkins?
The woman stood and motioned to the seat across from her. Jenny started to turn away. Why should she volunteer to be interrogated again? Before she took a step, though, she saw the yellowed cinder block wall of the visiting room, the same walls that confined all the inmates into 400-foot squares. Anything was better than her tiny cell. At least in here she had company. And she should, she supposed, find out what Gabby wanted. If the police had uncovered some new evidence, they might try to make her stand trial for Rachel's murder. Jenny settled into the offered seat. I'm surprised to see you. She let the fact hang rather than connect it to any pleasantry. The detective's presence wasn't auspicious. I brought you a... The ring in Jenny's ear muffled the detective's final word. You brought something? I'm sorry, you have to speak up. I'm nearly deaf in one ear, and I have tinnitus. Detective Watkins's brow wrinkled. She leaned over her chair arm toward the floor and grabbed a small brown paper bag, which she placed on the table. Jenny controlled her hands and her curiosity. For all she knew, it was evidence that the detective hoped she'd coat with her prints. What is it? Her visitor pulled the bag toward her and removed the square contents, a bound journal with a black and white drawing of Virginia Woolf on the cover. Above it, in a stylized script, was a quote from the author. A self that goes on changing is a self that goes on living. I always liked that one, the detective said, passing the book across the table. Jenny eyed the woman as she accepted the gift. Did she feel guilty for putting her in here? Was she afraid that Jenny might kill herself, spending Mother's Day away from her daughter? And did she believe some life-affirming quotes might stave off any tying together of the bedsheets? Jenny flipped through the book's pages, expecting to find a bunch of inspirational and unintentionally mocking words to live by. Instead, the pages were blessedly blank. I figured that you might like to write down some of what happened to you. Detective Watkins's closed-lipped smile made Jenny feel like there was something behind the woman's teeth. Why? What do you think I'll write? The question shot out more barbed than Jenny had intended. She was too anxious for the detective to get to the point of her visit to make their conversation sound like anything other than automatic fire. I don't know. Gabby folded her hands atop the table. There might be things you need to get off your chest. Like my affair with Ben. Fortunately for Jenny, the press had never uncovered the relationship. Jenny supposed they'd been too busy focusing on the killer doc, as they'd named Lewis in the tabloids. The lurid story of a respected emergency room surgeon harboring murderous desires had been sufficiently newsworthy that the media hadn't snooped around Ben and Rachel's marriage. As far as anyone outside the East Hampton Detective Bureau was concerned, Lewis had killed Rachel because of his anger over the lawsuit and its potential impact on his career. I'm sorry, but why are you here? The detective's eyes fell to her hands. Jenny was shocked to see her rubbing her knuckles as though she were the nervous one. I need to know. I know I won't prove it. There's no DNA. Ben denies that you two were ever more than friends. But Jenny stiffened in her chair. She knew the question Detective Watkins would ask. It was the same one all prisoners faced down daily. Did you do it? In my mind, I keep seeing Lewis fall back at the sound of the gun and then you pushing him. I want to know what role I played in everything. The detective shook a hand through her straightened hair. Was Lewis trying to save himself from being arrested, or was he telling the truth that day I shot at him? Detective Watkins looked at her, as though Jenny might be crazy enough to reveal the truth simply to give this strange woman peace of mind. Jenny stared back. Gabby sighed.
Did you do it because you were sleeping with her husband? Did you kill Rachel?
The sound of Rachel's name intensified the rushing white noise in her damaged ear and the impossibly high shriek that grew louder whenever Jenny's head hit a pillow. The sounds overwhelmed her brain, dragging it back to that night, as they so often did, to when she'd run through the scrub forest to the beach, desperate to convince Rachel not to reveal the affair to Lewis. Rachel stood on the black rocks, haloed by the moonlight. Jenny removed her sneakers at the water's edge and stepped into the fizzing remnants of a wave. Cold froth splattered her calves. She hoisted herself onto the jetty, picking her way in the near dark toward the woman ignoring her advance. As she drew within striking distance, Rachel whirled toward her as though she'd been waiting for Jenny to come close enough to land a punch. She'd removed her beach cover-up, perhaps realizing that a fight was coming and not wanting to give Jenny any opportunity to pull her down. Tears stained Rachel's face, made paler and prettier by the white glow overhead.
"I'm sorry," Jenny shouted above the wave's repetitive crash. "It was a mistake. I never meant for it to happen. Lewis beats me, Rachel. I went over one day to pick up Allie after a bad fight, and Ben saw my bleeding head. He realized what was going on and comforted me. I was so relieved to have someone's support that I acted foolishly. I'm so sorry, but it's over and
you're pathetic, Jen."
Rachel's volume shot above the crashing surf. "And stupid. You know that? You really think Ben just magically figured it out? I told him what was going on a year ago. It was so obvious, the way you'd walk around town like a spanked dog with your head down and your makeup slathered on, wearing big sunglasses in fucking November. I told Ben that Lewis hit you. I even asked him if I should talk to you. And what do you think Ben said to do? Call the police? No. He said we should stay out of it. Stay out of it, I guess, so when the timing was right, he could get you to spread your legs simply by saying that you were too pretty to be popped in the face." Rachel's tirade felt like a punch to the solar plexus. Jenny recalled her first time with Ben, how he'd seemed to know that Lewis had caused her head injury before she'd even tried to stutter an explanation. Rachel laughed.
"What's wrong, Jen? You feel betrayed?"
The moonlight that had softened Rachel's features suddenly sharpened them, casting a triangle of shadow from her nose over the left side of her face. The dark side possessed a sinister quality, as though Rachel had peeled back her pale skin to reveal a demon beneath. Jenny pleaded with Rachel's illuminated side.
"I know you're angry, but don't tell Lewis. Or fine, tell him, just not tonight. You know he can be violent. I need a day to get Allie and take us someplace safe."
Rachel scoffed. She'd been so ridiculous with her makeup and strategic outfits, Jenny thought. She hadn't hidden anything. Rachel had known. Ben had known. Maybe everyone knew. Jenny couldn't let her shame distract her from her begging.
"Please, Rachel," she continued. "Hold off on telling him for 24 hours.
The ocean hissed and spit at the rocks, a chorus urging Rachel to show no mercy.
"You think I'll help you? You slept with my husband. I can't wait to tell Lewis that his wife is an unfaithful whore. And if you're worried about Allie, you should have thought about that before breaking up her best friend's family."
Jenny should have known her pleading would be futile. She'd slept with her supposed friend's husband in the woman's house. Her behavior was beyond forgiveness. Still, she couldn't let her daughter pay for her mistakes. She launched herself at her neighbor. As Rachel raised her arm to block her hit, Jenny changed trajectories, instinctually curling her hands around Rachel's neck the way Lewis had done hours earlier.
Rachel coughed as Jenny squeezed her thumbs into the notch between Rachel's collarbones. The sound of the air escaping Rachel's throat only made Jenny squeeze harder.
You can't tell him,
Jenny screamed over the rushing waves. You
can't!
Her bare feet suddenly hit a silken surface. She slipped on it, falling back into the water and dragging Rachel down with her, along with what she realized had been Rachel's kimono. Cold water enveloped her, sending a pain up her limbs. Her breath froze in her lungs. A high-pitched sound pierced her shock. Rachel was screaming. Her suit had snagged a rock, ripping the shoulder strap and wounding her back. Jenny stood, pressing her feet against the sandy bottom. The water, she realized, barely reached the tops of her thighs.
You bitch!
Rachel shouted, seemingly loud enough for Lewis to hear back in the house.
I hope he kills you. I hope he fucking kills you, you!
Before she could say, Jenny grabbed Rachel's head. She shoved it beneath the surface, watching the unspoken words bubble around her. She didn't let go until all the bubbles vanished. Jenny looked at her hands, at the jagged nails that hadn't seen polish, and at the lines of dirt crusted underneath them. She fought the desire to pick out the grime. She knew that her awareness of what her fingers had done to Rachel, how they'd wrapped around her neck and pressed her beneath the waves, fueled the urge.
Did you do it?
Detective Watkins asked again. Jenny read her lips. The whooshing sound in her ear was so loud, the scream so high and unending. Sometimes Jenny thought it would drive her insane.
Why do you care so much about Rachel? Jenny asked, surrendering to her desire to pick the dirt beneath her thumbnail.
She wasn't the type to care about others. Do you know that she knew Lewis was abusing me? For over a year, apparently. She'd talked about it with other people, but she never once asked me if I was all right, if I needed help. Sometimes I think if I'd only had someone to snap me out of what was happening, to say to me, what's going on between you and your husband isn't something that should be rationalized. I don't know. Maybe things wouldn't have happened the way they did.
Detective Watkins nodded with a grave look, probably the same one Jenny had displayed when she'd been waiting for her to get to the point.
But Rachel never talked to me like that, Jenny continued, sharing the silent justifications that helped her sleep at night. It was always these shallow conversations. Who makes those jeans you're wearing? Do you know any good decorators in the area?
Rachel was the kind of person that would realize your husband had beat the crap out of you and ask if you were going to a charity ball on the following Thursday.
Detective Watkins gave her a look of strained interest. So you thought she deserved to die?
Of course she didn't deserve to die. Jenny stopped picking her nails and folded her hands in front of her, as in prayer.
She couldn't let emotion lead her into a confession.
I'm sorry that Rachel is dead. I really am.
Jenny's throat tightened around the harsh truth. A tear she didn't realize she'd shed tumbled from her cheek onto the table, leaving a damp circle on the surface.
All I'm saying is that maybe we're all a little responsible when we turn a blind eye. I don't know. Maybe if Rachel and I had been better friends to one another, things would have been different for all of us.
Jenny looked directly into Detective Watkins's brown irises, the mirror in many ways of her own eyes. Maybe women should do more to help other women. Detective Watkins stared at her like she could see the words materializing in the space between them. She seemed to look through them to Jenny's face, trying to decipher some coded message. Jenny knew, though, that she'd said nothing definitive.
As much as she wanted Detective Watkins to understand, she couldn't risk the courts holding her responsible for Rachel's death, too. She had her daughter to get back to. Jenny palmed the book and then pushed the chair back from the table. "Thanks, Detective." Detective Watkins stood. "Wait, I need to know." Jenny looked directly in the woman's face. "You know how Rachel died. Lewis killed her. He couldn't control his anger. He went out to talk to her about his case. They clearly fought, and he killed her. Then, when he realized that Ben wasn't going to be his patsy, he decided that he could make up a contemptible story and pin it on me." Jenny shrugged. "You shot at the right man, Detective. Rachel's murderer is dead." Detective Watkins blinked, seemingly processing the picture while simultaneously scanning for signs that it had been altered, perhaps sensing something off. In her own way, Jenny decided, she'd told her the truth. She turned toward the guard and pointed to the door, asking permission to leave. The steel door buzzed open. Its loud alert heightened the wail of white noise in her head. Jenny closed her eyes and counted to 10, like she was waiting out a contraction. The worst of the sound would subside, but for the rest of her life, she would hear that scream over the waves. This concludes the reading of One Little Secret, a novel by Kate Holohan. Copyright 2019 by Katherine Holohan. This book was read by Hilary Huber. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Crooked Lane Books and was produced in 2019 by Blackstone Publishing, which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Publishing. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.